whole lot of the early astronauts were first test pilots. You see this really well portrayed in the 1983 movie, The Right Stuff.
Land at 180 degrees.
Jose Jimenez.
It follows brave, sometimes reckless, test pilots making the transition to being astronauts.
They want to make me an astronaut. Oh, I hope not.
But for that first batch of astronauts, the Mercury 7 as they're called, NASA had a lot of requirements for people to even apply. Like, you had to be, number one, less than 40 years old, less than 5 feet 11 inches tall, because you had to fit in a spaceship, in excellent physical condition, with a bachelor's degree or equivalent, a graduate of a test pilot school, and you had to have a minimum of 1,500 hours total flying time as a qualified jet pilot. So basically, to be an astronaut back in the day, you had to be a pretty good pilot.
Sounds dangerous.
It is.
Very dangerous.
Count me in.
From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm your host, Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up. The show that takes you deep into the cosmos or just to the telescope in your backyard to learn more about what makes this amazing universe of ours so great. Our guests this week are Dr. Jonathan Rathsum and Ed Herring from NASA's Quest mission.
Into the soft light of this Florida dawn emerges Friendship 7, making its debut to the day of its destiny.
So I'm definitely an Ohio boy, and growing up, my favorite astronaut was John Glenn. Sorry, Neil Armstrong. I know you're from Ohio, too.
The Mercury Atlas stands alone, waiting to depart this Earth. All to hurdle a 168-pound astronaut into space.
John Glenn was my astronaut. I don't know why. Like, there's, you know, Neil Armstrong, first person to walk on the moon, but John Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth.
Astronaut John Glenn of New Concord, Ohio. Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps.
The first two Americans that went into space, they went up high enough to be technically in space. They're called suborbital flights, where they go up and then they come back down. So they go up to the limits of space, but not circle the Earth. That's why I thought John Glenn's mission was so cool, because he got to circle the entire globe in, you know, like about an hour and a half or so, and look down on so many parts of the Earth. So he's basically the first American to see the whole world at one time.
Oh, that view is tremendous.
I try to imagine what that must have been like. If you're looking out that window, what would you be looking for?
To John Glenn, now belongs an awesome panorama. The world curving beneath him, just as it was filmed from an earlier Mercury capsule.
Roger, Seven.
And the other thing you notice is that there's no, like, lines between the countries. You know, it's all a big mass of land or water. But of course, the first person to orbit the Earth did it way before John Glenn, and that was the Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin.
Ever since the Russian word Sputnik gained a firm foothold in the languages of all the peoples of the Earth, it was clear that the first space flight would be made by a Soviet man.
I gotta admit, you know, as an American growing up in the 1980s, well, the accomplishments of the Soviet space program were muted, to put it mildly. I mean, I can't say I ever learned one fact about the Soviet missions as a kid.
Man had his first great success in space when the Russians pushed a man across the threshold. He was Yuri Gagarin, the astronaut the Russians lionized as the first to orbit the Earth. It was the propaganda coup of the year.
Just to put this in perspective, Yuri Gagarin flew around the Earth one time on April 12, 1961. And so April 12th is now known as Yuri's Night, and that's mostly known in places around the world, less so around the United States. But this was more than 10 months before John Glenn's flight. So as far as firsts, I mean, Yuri Gagarin is the first one to circle the Earth, and John Glenn came afterwards. One more little bit of John Glenn trivia, which I like. So in 1957, so this is years before his orbital flight, He took off in an experimental jet from California and flew to New York in 3 hours and 23 minutes.
9 a.m., Marine Airman Major John Glenn begins an attempt at a supersonic transcontinental flight.
This was like a speed record. This was the stuff that the pilots did. They wanted to fly the fastest and cover the most ground. So his speed was hovering around 725 miles per hour, and his project was called Project Bullet. The most interesting part of it to me is that he recorded it. Like, he had a camera on the plane filming the entire 3 hours and 23 minute journey from takeoff to touchdown. And it was the first such film, basically, of the entire country.
Glenn's wife and children watched proudly as he taxied in, holder of a new record that shaves more than 21 minutes off the best previous time.
We may fly in planes today without really looking down on the landscape, but not me, man. I love looking out the window whenever I'm flying. You know, when I always get a window seat. If I get stuck in an aisle seat, oh man, I am not happy. And I am looking out that window almost every second of the trip because it's really incredible. It's really amazing the fact that we can fly through the air, number one, and that I can look down out of that window and see the country, see the land below. And I guess I just got the John Glenn bug. I mean, flying is just never boring for me. So today we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Rathsum, Senior Research Engineer at NASA Langley, and Ed Herring, Aerospace Engineer at NASA Armstrong. So first off, Jonathan, tell me about the Quest mission and what makes this X-59 aircraft so exciting and special.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you know, the whole Quest mission, it has two main goals. The first goal is to create an airplane that can fly supersonic without creating a sonic boom. The second goal of the mission is to fly this aircraft over different localities across the United States and to do a public survey to find out what people's reactions are to this new sound of supersonic flight. And that data is going to be collected and shared with noise regulators at the national and international level.
Well, so has there been a ban on supersonic aircraft, and what was happening to cause that?
Yes. Since 1973, there's been a ban on commercial supersonic flight over land. And that ban was put in place after some community testing that happened in the late 1960s, which found that supersonic aircraft of that era were too loud.
Flight speeds like this produce a sonic boom, and there's nothing the pilot or anyone else can do about it.
Yes, Major, no change in the cockpit, but down below, it's an entirely different matter.
The sonic booms were too disturbing in communities for it to be publicly acceptable.
Scientific research teams and industrial firms are working on the problem, but for the present, we must realize that the sonic boom is unavoidable.
And so that ban was put in place. That ban had its 50-year anniversary last year, and that's why NASA is looking into this technology, you know, based on laboratory testing that we've done, and based on wind tunnel testing, it looks like we can design an aircraft that flies supersonically, like I said, without that sonic boom. But we can't know what people's reactions are outside of the laboratory in their own homes, going about their daily routines, unless we test this at full scale.
And so is there a hope that someday, you know, the average person can go on something like this?
Yes, that's absolutely. The goal is to improve life for the traveling public, get people to their destinations faster so they can spend less time traveling.
Well, and Ed, so although this aircraft is the X-59, it'll be supersonic. Engineers are expecting it to be a lot quieter when breaking the sound barrier. So, like, what causes this sonic boom that people would hear if this thing, you know, for previous supersonic aircraft? And how can you make it more of a sonic burp, thump?
We call it the sonic thump. And most people don't have experience with supersonic airplanes, but most people have seen boats on the water, motorboats. There's kind of an analogy there. When a motorboat's going across a nice calm lake, you'll see this V-shaped wake behind the boat. And that's because it's disturbing the water. That's the two-dimensional case of what we're doing in three dimensions, flying an airplane. We're flying an airplane faster than the air can get out of the way.
Sound expands in a sphere. The sound source produces vibrations which travel in all directions as waves of compressed air. They combine to form a percussion wave, which a person perceives as a very sharp booming sound.
So what happens is anytime you have a change in the aircraft shape or lift, it produces a shock wave. And the problem is, until now, all those little shock waves from all the different parts of the plane would all combine into a one huge shock at the front and one huge shock in the back. And on the ground, you'd hear boom, boom. So what we're trying to do with X-59 is we're trying to keep all those little shocks separated. So as it goes down from high altitude to the ground, they get weaker and weaker and never combine. So you'll just hear a little bit of a thump. We're targeting a sound that's kind of like someone 20 feet away slams a car door. You hear it, but it doesn't bother you. It's not a big deal. And if you're engaged in conversation, you may not even notice the sound at all. But we're going to be flying this over rural areas, urban areas, all kinds of different climates, because the weather does affect it. And we, you know, wind and turbulence and things like that, humidity. So we'll be testing in all different cases to ensure that this plane is always giving us a sonic thump and not a sonic boom.
In order to achieve this special design, the cockpit had to be built without a forward-facing window. So there's a camera that's looking directly ahead and a really high-resolution display for the pilot to see, but the pilot can't see directly, you know, forward out of a window.
And what would be what's the cruising speed going to be, you know, like compared to a normal, passenger plane?
So this is going to be going 1.4 times the speed of sound, or Mach 1.4. So it's about 925 miles an hour. Most commercial jets, they fly a bit slower, Mach 8.9. This is a stepping stone. When we get a fleet of supersonic commercial planes, they might be flying double the speed they are now. So you can get wherever you want in the world in half the time. That's the goal.
Half the travel time. That sounds pretty cool. We're going to be having a community testing phase. So like, how can people in the community share their thoughts on the sound that they're hearing?
Absolutely. During the community test phase, the X-59 will fly over different locations. Like I said, it'll spend about a month in each location. It's flying over multiple times a day. And there will be a survey. So we're going to conduct between 4 and 6 of these community surveys across the U.S. taken together. We want that sample of people to be representative of all areas across the country.
And so will the folks listening for this, will they know ahead of time when it's coming, or is it like random and you're just like trying to catch them in a normal day?
Yes, exactly. Trying to catch them going about their normal activities. We would send them a reminder after the aircraft has passed to go fill in a survey, but we wouldn't prompt them beforehand to say, get ready, you know, be listening for it. We would just want to see what their reactions are without prompting.
So this is a test where you hope they don't even notice. And the idea isn't to go to space. So, you know, what's the altitude, I guess, it's going to be mostly kind of tested out at?
Above 50,000 feet. The plane can go up to 60,000. And by adjusting the altitude and speed a little bit, we can make the plane a little bit quieter, a little bit louder.
And the big question I have for you is, when will it be ready, and when do you two get to fly in it?
I don't think we ever get to fly in it because it's a single-seat airplane. And neither Jonathan or I are fighter pilots or, you know, NASA research pilots. But we have a good number of folks here who've been training, and they fly military planes and NASA research planes. It's projected to fly this year for first flight, and it's going to take about 9 months to get all the testing done to make sure it's safe to fly. And then in 2025, we're going to do some research making sure it's quiet enough, various measurements on the ground and up in the air. And then 2026 or so, we'll start doing those community tests.
All right. Well, this checks out. You guys are real engineers. You're interested in building it and not flying it. It's a good way to do it. Only put one seat on there. That guarantees you're not going to go in it, right? Well, this is a pretty exciting project. I can't wait to see how this goes. And I wonder, maybe I can be one of the test subjects. If you put me on the list, it flies over us here in Cincinnati. We'd love to be part of it. Either way, I think it's going to be a great mission, and good luck with it. Thanks so much for chatting with us today.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for bringing us onto your program.
A lot of people ask me about the private space companies, the companies that send people up for a good fee up into quote unquote space. And, what do I think about them? And is there ever going to be a time when the average person can go into space? I mean, I have totally mixed feelings about these private space trips and companies because they're not really, well, number one, they're suborbital. And we already know how I feel about suborbital flights. It's up and down. You don't even go around the Earth like John Glenn. So I'm like, They're pretty expensive, that's for sure. And they're not really breaking any new ground or testing out any new technologies. They're kind of going where people have gone before. So I'm not a huge fan of the private space companies. If you ask me the other question, would I go on one? Well, all my objections disappear. Of course I would go. Of course. If they asked me, I'd totally go. Give me a flight. Give me, Elon, call me up. I mean, Jeff, I'm available. Never mind that I don't really think they're doing much, but sure, it'd be fun. I mean, if you're going to do it, why not take me? Yeah, that sounds good. So here's your homework for this episode. Let us know what you would do to get on a suborbital flight. Like, what would you pay? What wouldn't you pay? Who would you, have to schmooze with? I don't know. Or what if there's no way you'd ever go up into space in one of those rockets? Totally legit answer also. So write to us at lookingup@wvxu.org and maybe we can pull some strings with those powers that be and get you up into space. And one other thing, let's say you want to participate in the Quest mission. You want to help log some data. You want to know what the flight logs are going to be. And maybe even if you want a boarding pass to watch a flight, you can do that by going to nasa.gov/quest. That's Q-U-E-S-S-T. Looking Up with Dean Regas is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds and I created it. Ella Rowan is our show producer and editor and definitely has the right stuff for the job. Go, Ella. Marshall Verbsky assists with audio production, editing, and flies around the studio so fast he creates mini sonic booms. Ooh, can we add one of those in post? I don't know, I think we should. Janelle Walton is our vice president of content. Ronnie Salerno is our digital platforms manager. And Brittany Matey is our social media coordinator. Our theme song is Possible Light by Ziv Moran. And our cover art is by Nicole Chance. Keep looking up.